opportunistic infections mean? We have them in our bodies. As an example, the herpes on your lips or the blisters in your mouth, which can be a Coxsackie virus infection, very, very common in Canada. Interestingly, I think it's the same percentage as we find Lyme disease in Canada or more. You have different reactivations of this. Normally immune-controlled viruses or chlamydia, mycoplasma, which makes some sinusitis, some slime production, biofilms, also intracellular. So we need to differentiate. It's not enough to say this is Lyme disease because symptoms are not specific for Lyme disease.
Now, feel free to dodge this question, but I have to ask, why do companies, countries, and the medical profession continue to use flawed tests?
Yeah, this is a good question. They don't accept chronic infections. In all of the years, I have learned that I accept chronic infections, chronic Lyme, chronic bartonellosis, chronic rickettsiosis, but the majority of doctors don't accept this. They say, yes, you can have a current, a recent infection, a fresh infection, but it cannot get chronic. This is the struggle we have politically with this societies doing the guidelines. So what I'm fighting for, the acceptance of chronic infection, and this we can do by this wonderful blood test like the TickPlex, TickPlex Basic, TickPlex Plus, the ELISpots, also the natural killer cells are helpful. We can do from bloodstream. We cannot do biopsies. We cannot do surgery from nerves. We cannot do surgery from brain to do biopsies. To do the direct test for the pathogen by culture and PCR, it's impossible.
And then I know this year you've been really busy, your laboratory's been very busy testing for COVID. And I also saw on your website that you have therapists that are using the Armin lab tests for clinical serological monitoring for COVID patients. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I like the infections. I like the viruses in diagnosing them in general. It's not just SARS-CoV-2. This is my specialty for years, and my clinical time in the early 90s, I was clinical infectious disease consultant for a while. So I know how to handle clinically with the symptoms, and I'm a medical doctor too. So what I see in this model with the three eyes with this SARS-CoV-2. We diagnose it with antibodies, IgG, IgA, very, very interesting marker, the IgA. I would like that for Borrelia burgdorferi, the IgA antibodies, local inflammatory antibodies, IgG, IgM are not representing localized infections, inflammation. And the second eye is the immune dysfunction. So I like immunology to offer some tests for that. And the last three eye we need to diagnose and treat in all of these infections, not just SARS-CoV-2, is the inflammation, the inflammatory markers. We can do some cytokines, TH1, TH2. So we have good chances in laboratory also to help therapists and to give additional information about infection, inflammation, and immune dysfunction.
Oh, that must be so helpful to see those changes in their patients. Are you?
Yes. Yeah. Very, very interesting. Also, the therapists need to do that. It's not just enough to say, I do now my antibodies or my, for SARS-CoV-2, we have also the iSpot, it's called. We can differentiate between past infection and currently active infection with interleukin 2. We have the same test also now for Borrelia burgdorferi, the iSpot it's named with interleukin 2. But nevertheless, a test never can exclude anything, please. A neurologist can never exclude neuroborreliosis, never. There's no test in the world for exclusion. We can say it's a high sensitivity, it's a high specificity, but we need to think clinically. We need to accept that the patient is telling you for Lyme disease or other infections.
Are you seeing people test other tissues from the body as well?
Yes, in Europe we have this acrodermatitis, which is a very dry skin on the hands, as an example, we can do biopsies and we can check for Borrelia burgdorferi in that with a pathologist and also PCR specialist. But nevertheless, the to prove it in the tissue is also not 100% sensitive. So we have a lot of false negatives there. It's not so easy to diagnose by PCR. You have also learned from SARS-CoV-2. So there's no 100% guarantee. But if you have a tissue biopsy or do surgery, you can do the hip. As an example, if you have a hip replacement, you can send laboratories some parts of the bone which has the arthritis and then the arthrosis, and then we can try to find out Borrelia burgdorferi and other pathogens.
Oh, it really sounds like you're pushing the boundaries there. I just have one more question. I'm curious about, are you seeing any correlation between COVID and the Epstein-Barr virus or any other infections?
Yes, I have developed, because I'm coming from this opportunistic field, so I work with HIV patients, the same situation as you have here, we have here with the SARS-CoV-2 patients, immune suppression and so, and a lot of these HIV patients have not problems with HIV, they have problems with these opportunistic infections, EBV, CMV, cytomegalovirus, Coxsackie virus, echovirus, also herpes simplex virus, HHV6, HHV7, HHV8, so they have a lot of virus problems, also yeast and mold, because they're immune suppressed. And we have this exactly the same model in SARS-CoV-2. Therefore, I developed an opportunistic checklist for that. It's not a Lyme disease checklist, for also long COVID, to find out clinically which symptoms are EBV symptoms, which symptoms are parvovirus, B19 symptoms, also a heart rhythm problem virus. It's not just all Borrelia burgdorferi doing heart rhythm problems. So you can differentiate. It costs nothing. You can download on website or I can send you. And then clinically, you can differentiate which infection might be active in which long COVID patient. And I did this successfully with a lot of patients, and we find a lot of EBV, Epstein-Barr virus reactivations. And interestingly, last sentence to that, 1-2 weeks ago, there came studies about that. I think 30% of long COVID patients might have reactivations of Epstein-Barr viruses, but EBV. But these groups are not checking for other viruses. This is what I cannot accept. Normally, you should check for multiple infections. All of these patients have several viruses active. It's not just one. So we need to come more to chronic multiple reactivations of these normally immune-controlled viruses.
Wow. And I mean, just compiling all of that data and analyzing it must be such an important part. What is next in testing?
Yeah, what is next? The next chapter, I would like to have a biofilm test. Because we have a lot of biofilm discussions with Borrelia, Lyme disease, and also Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, Yersinia, Campylobacter, whatever. So we need biofilms because they are communication areas, and we need some tests for that, I'm sure. Also, what is coming next? I'm in the parasites now working more and more. We don't have so many good tests for parasitic infections, Toxocaracanis, very common together with Lyme disease, with neuropsychiatric symptoms, or Ascaris zoom, which has to do with the dogs and the cats and your domestics, as an example, mm-hmm. eat up the eggs. So I'm more in the field now, also parasites, viruses, other bacteria, gut viruses, very, very interesting. Everybody has a problem. I diagnosed with Lyme disease with the gut, and nearly all in Canada have Coxsackie virus, echovirus, double infection, so you need to treat the virus. Also, you need to treat the gut, the natural immunity. Also, a challenge will be the gut bacteria, and where I'm not so strong, where we need more tests and also more input, is the yeast and mold field in the world.
Wow, well, that was absolutely incredible. I just want to thank you so much for joining us on our podcast and teaching all of our listeners this complicated part of Lyme disease diagnostics. Thank you, Armin.
Thank you, Sarah, so much. And don't fear a tick, you know, don't fear a tick bite. We have good chances to diagnose nowadays and also good treatment options. The mistakes are not done from our side.
Yeah, that's a really great point. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, so much. Have a nice day.
Dr. Armin Schwarzbach has been studying diagnostic tests for Borrelia burgdorferi and co-infections for years. We reached him in Munich, and I'm sure glad we did. It was so interesting to hear him explain the difference between co-infections and opportunistic infections, and also to learn about the different forms of Borrelia, such as the persister form. That's another podcast of Can Lyme's Looking at Lyme. Thank you for listening, and remember, stay safe in the outdoors.
Guatemala, a Central American country that borders Mexico, was most recently in the news for finding a former president guilty of genocide.
By unanimous decision, the court declares that the accused José Efraín Ríos Montt is responsible as the author of the crime of genocide.
Even though the trial was restarted on a technicality, this is all part of the country's effort to overcome the effects of a devastating civil war that lasted 30 years. The conflict, which started in the 50s, was fought between leftist guerrillas and the army. The UN estimates that 25,000 people died, but other organizations say it could be as high as 40,000.
During a 36-year civil war, 45,000 students, political activists, and peasants were disappeared, and 200,000 Mayan Indians were killed in the countryside.
Nati Garcia is the daughter of a Guatemalan couple who fled the war. They arrived in Vancouver when she was 3 years old. Now 30, Nati is 5'5", dark-skinned, she's got brown eyes and a quick smile. Despite arriving at a very young age, Nati usually wears traditional Mayan clothing and identifies with the culture her family left behind. Nati's parents are Mayan, a group of indigenous people who live in Central America and parts of Mexico. They were heavily targeted by the military during the war. Like thousands of other Guatemalan refugees, Nati's family was forced to flee when their hometown became a battleground. According to Nati, when they arrived in Vancouver in the late 1980s, they didn't have many things to call their own.
We lived in a two-bedroom place, our first home, and it was about five of us. So we all shared this one mattress. So there was a lot of tension sometimes, and people wanted their own space, but didn't get that, but we'd all have to sleep on one mattress. And I remember that. And everything was very old in the household. Everything was secondhand. It was gifted. It was from donations. And I remember our clothes never really fit us well enough.
Vancouver is nothing like the place her parents grew up in. Her family is from a region called Ixcán in the Guatemalan jungle. Even though her family didn't have many material possessions, Fabiana Morales, Nati's mom, has fond memories of the village she grew up in. Given its climate and location, it was a perfect place to grow crops. So despite being a poor area, Fabiana says they were never hungry. Violence spilled into Ixcán when Fabiana was 18 years old. The leftist guerrilla had been operating in the region for a while, but the real problem started when the discovery of natural resources got the army interested in occupying those lands. The army was brutal in its mission to control Ixcán. They used the scorched earth strategy, destroying everything in their path and killing everyone who they considered a threat to their control over the region. Fabiana, who only speaks Spanish and Mayan mam, told us about when the army made its way into her village.
The next day we saw it with our own eyes. We saw smoke. They were already burning the houses. They were burning everything in their way. So we left.
Fabiana and her family fled to the mountains. The lush vegetation provided many hiding spots, but the army was tirelessly tracking them down.
Entonces ellos se dieron cuenta que si hay gente todavía viviendo.
The army realized that some people were still alive. They started shooting everything that moved. We heard the shots being fired, and that was the day we decided we couldn't hide there anymore.
Ill-equipped for the journey through the treacherous Guatemalan jungle, some decided to stay behind.
My father said, "You go. I will stay here to die because I don't have little ones." So he stayed. He said, "I'm going to find a little corner here in the mountain." My parents lived on that mountain for 12 years.
Fabiana and her family spent 8 years as refugees in Mexico. When they arrived in Canada, other Guatemalan refugees became the only connection to the land they had left behind. Before we continue, we want to warn listeners that the next section contains a testimony that some people could find disturbing.
When I was 8 and 9 years old, we went to a friend's place in Surrey. We were really good friends with them at that time. My parents were good friends with them at that time. It was a celebration, a party. So we went to this person's place to be in that space again. And we had ended up staying that night at that friend's place because my parents weren't sober enough to go back home. And all the kids that were there with her had ended up being put in a room where we'd sleep all together. And we'd slept there a few times in the past. But this one night in particular, when I was really young, there was this one person that came in to that room when I was asleep. And I remember waking up feeling that it was a dream and it was really dark. And this young gentleman, this young person had kind of woken me up by pressing his arms onto my body. And I remember opening my eyes and seeing this person looking at me, and I remember having this feeling of fear, this feeling of pain, this feeling of what is happening. And then this person had ended up doing these sexual kind of actions that I wasn't familiar with at that age. And I actually ended up closing my eyes really tightly and hoping that it would go away, and then ended up waking up my eyes, opening my eyes again, and it was daylight, and all the kids were awake. Somebody was making breakfast downstairs in the kitchen, and I remember thinking to myself that maybe it was a bad dream. Maybe it was something that I always felt that it was a bad dream.
Even though the experience had left her deeply disturbed, Nati decided not to tell anyone what had happened to her.
I didn't tell anybody because I felt I didn't understand it. I wasn't sure. I would never had that conversation with my parents about respecting your body, about if you ever feel anyone that does any harm to you in any way, or if you feel scared in any way, any moment, to let us know. I hadn't had those conversations with my parents or had built that trust enough with my parents.
That wasn't the only topic they didn't discuss, though. Nati's parents had never told their children about the hardships they faced during their exile. Nati's questions were always met with evasives or silence. When Fabiana arrived in Canada, the country felt like a totally foreign place to her. She didn't know anyone, so she stayed home a lot. Unable to grow her own food, Fabiana felt she couldn't connect to this new land. And without any professional help, she and her husband were having issues coping with their past.
My husband used to have a lot of problems. He was maybe 20 or 25 years old when the war started, and that kind of affected him. He used to feel a little bit of rage, and that made him start drinking.
Sometimes at the house he would be drunk, and all that rage he had, he would take it out on us. He would take it out on the family. Sometimes he would hurt the family. So the children started being afraid of him.
My parents' relationship was, I feel, was full of a lot of tensions. I remember listening and witnessing to some of the arguments that they would have and not understanding where it came from, but only feeling the emotions that came from it.
All the tension, sadness, and silence drew Nati away from home. Feeling disconnected to her own family, she befriended other teenagers from troubled homes. At age 12, she became sexually active, and then she started drinking and doing drugs. Her parents didn't know what she was up to. She barely spoke to them.
My relationship with my parents during my childhood was, there was a lot of anger. I did not communicate with them at all about anything. I hated them. Like, I just, especially my dad, I hated my dad. I felt that he had brought all of this pain to me. I felt it was because of his alcoholism. It was because of the violence that he brought into the household that it drove me to where I was as a teenager. And my mom, I hated my mom because I felt that she wasn't there for me.
Nati still hadn't come to terms with what had happened to her as a child. She frequently had a disturbing dream about a shadow sexually forcing itself into her. But she hadn't considered the possibility that the dreams were based on reality. Everything changed one day when she ran into a familiar figure while picking blueberries with her mom.
I remember in a far distance seeing this figure of a man talking to my mom and I guess talking to the other family members there. And I remember just this feeling of fear just entering my body. I just became paralyzed. That paralyzation, similar to what had happened during that incident, I felt that again. And I was triggered by this figure and did not know what it was. And it wasn't until later, and I had like run into like the blueberry bushes and I had just hid there. I just stayed there. I didn't want to come out. And not until later on in the evening when that person had left and we had gone back home, I started to ponder on that question as to why I had felt that way. And I came to realize that this feeling really was connected to the dream that I had. And I didn't know fully then, but it was a start into opening that wound of understanding that this was not a dream. What had happened was real.
After realizing that she had been a victim of sexual assault, she confided it to her best friend, who encouraged her to deal with it. It was the first time Nati said what had happened to her out loud.
I cried a lot. It was the first time I had cried in front of anybody, and it was with her because I trusted her. She was the first person I really, really trusted, so she held that space for me to share my childhood.
Finally, being able to talk to someone about the experience proved helpful. But Nati still hadn't dealt with many of the underlying issues. She spent the next 10 years taking refuge in alcohol, drugs, and destructive relationships. By then, her parents had found a way to sober up by reconnecting with their indigenous roots. But Nati was convinced this strategy wouldn't work for her. Looking for a fresh start, she and her best friend moved to Montreal. But the new setting didn't change Nati's old habits. She continued to abuse drugs and alcohol. Her behavior eventually led to a fight with her friend. The fallout made Nati realize she had to fully confront what had happened to her as a child. So she went back home to tell her parents about it.
That conversation was very hard. It was one of the most challenging conversations I have had with my family. I remember all of us sitting kind of like a circle. And I remember nobody had any idea why they were there, or why this was being initiated by me. I told them that I hadn't told them because I didn't trust them. I didn't feel they would understand, or it was more of trust. I just didn't trust them, and I told them that. I had still hated them and had resentment towards them, so it was hard for me to share anything with them. So this was one of the first moments where I really shared something vulnerable to my parents.
Listening to Nati, Fabiana realized that keeping her children in the dark had created trust issues, so she decided to open up to them. After walking in the jungle for 8 days, Fabiana and her family finally made it to Mexico. But they soon realized they weren't alone. Thousands of people had fled to the neighboring country, where a makeshift refugee camp had been established near the border.
The United Nations had already arrived to help, but since we were thousands of people, we only got one or two tortillas a day. And that's not enough for a person. It's not enough to sustain a body. We didn't have any clothes. We didn't have cooking utensils. We had nothing. We went out looking for scraps, for anything we could use to boil some water. And that's when people started getting sick. One of my children died because he was struck by sickness.
The family was then sent to another refugee camp in the Mexican state of Campeche. They lived there for the next 8 years. It was here where Nati was born. The conditions were similar to the ones they had faced in the border.
The place they sent us to was dry. The water, well, they would only give us a liter per person per day. And that's not enough. The food was the same, it was rationed. So I would give my children all of it, even if I didn't eat anything.
Slowly, Fabiana lost hope. She started thinking that the family would have to stay in Campeche forever. But one day, out of the blue, they received a letter from Fabiana's brother-in-law. He had emigrated to Canada before the family fled to Mexico. He initially thought they had died during the conflict, but after discovering his family members were alive, he helped them resettle in Vancouver. It was then that Fabiana and her husband decided they would never discuss the details of their exile with their children.
I think that if my parents had been a bit more open to their own experience, it would have been a more safer space for me to be able to share my experience. Because I would have known that, wow, you've gone through so much. You can relate to my pain.
Nati's confession motivated her parents to finally share their experiences during the war. Understanding all the violence and trauma they endured for almost a decade has allowed her to put away her negative feelings towards them. She now embraces them for who they are. But Nati's commitment to break the silence goes well beyond her household. Now she's a social worker.
I'm very focused with youth and children because I realize the importance of the innocence, the importance of providing that nurturing space and empowering them as beautiful beings to see their true power and allow themselves to creatively explore it and connect with it.
Nati's family is still healing, but coping with decades of silence takes time and the help of every family member. Nati's parents don't drink anymore. The family has also found a place where they can grow traditional Guatemalan crops. Joining her parents at the farm has helped Nati reconnect with her indigenous roots. All of this makes Nati have high hopes for the future.
I'm still healing, so I see myself being a bit more liberated and free and working with a community, my community back home in Guatemala. And I see my family full of lots of love and joy, and I see them stronger. I see the roots of our household to be more grounded.
This documentary was produced by Carlos Tello and Aurora Tejeda with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We would like to thank Nati and Fabiana for sharing their stories with us.
Thanks for tuning in today to this Holiday Monday of Speak Up right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Magnus Tewald. I'll be back next Monday with another edition of the program and our special feature, What's Up in Burnaby, keep you up to speed on what's happening in Burnaby, plus another edition of Looking at Lyme, and lots of other interesting stuff. Please stay tuned for Democracy Now!, which is coming up right next. Wandering Rhythms up at noon. And more great programming coming up throughout the day here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
What you're about to hear is a rock musical about a...